Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop. For this Thursday, June 4th, I'm Ray Graff. SpaceX sent two NASA astronauts to the International Space Station last weekend. These are exciting times. An asteroid is coming. It may wipe us out. Who knows? Well, we welcome two astronomers into the studio today via the phone to help us sort all this stuff out. I think we'll probably be okay with the asteroid. And we'll find out for sure. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. And they're here to answer your questions about space, Mars, comets, anything else in the final frontier. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Astronomy Today, right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers on the line today to answer your questions about space and everything in it. Bob Berman is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. He is the host of Strange Universe, which is produced right here at WAMC. Dr. Valerie Rapson is the chief astronomer at the Dudley Observatory. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. The number to call if you have a question about space, the final frontier, give us a call at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes, great to be here.
Well, Valerie, you scared the daylights out of me a little earlier when you said the asteroid is coming. And I think we better clear this up right now.
Yes, yes. I've been getting so many emails and Facebook messages from people, but you shouldn't panic. Just because the media says there's an asteroid nearby doesn't mean it's actually going to hit the Earth.
I heard it's bigger than the Empire State Building.
Yeah, the one that they're talking about is like stadium size. It's like 1,100 feet wide, but it's only going to come within 3 million miles of Earth, which is tremendously far away.
Yeah, it's about 12 times farther than the moon.
So why the hoopla then?
Well, because people like to be scared. For some reason, more troubling than high cholesterol or high blood pressure is the destruction of the planet. I guess it's sort of attractive in a way that we all go at once singing, like they did on the deck of the Titanic, rather than, you know, individually. So this always draws a crowd. But as Valerie said, yeah, they're big, about 4 city blocks in size, big enough to do a lot of damage, and coming in at 15,000 miles an hour. It would be terrible if it hit us. But yeah, that distance, 12 times the distance to the moon at its closest, means really nothing to worry about.
All right. Well, I'm relaxed now. Thank you for that. Now, I don't know if either of you watched this. I assume you did. It's not really astronomy related, but I was very excited to see the SpaceX launch and the subsequent docking of the American astronauts at the space station. I thought that was tremendous.
Oh, yes, definitely. I definitely had a bunch of friends on Zoom, and we were all kind of watching together, cheering on the astronauts. It was great.
And you know, Ray, you know, I have split feelings about it. I mean, what I always try to do is just feel the pulse of the people on this, and I think if I'm reading the public correctly, everyone was excited about first going to the moon. I'm not sure people are going to be that excited about going back, just as the second people to climb Mount Everest did not have the, you know, the same juice, the same excitement as the as Hillary Clinton and Tenzing Norgay, you know, being first. So I think the public is excited about Mars, sending humans to Mars. I'm not getting a lot of continued buzz about the International Space Station. I mean, I like the idea that there's always people orbiting on Earth, but they're only as close to Earth as Philadelphia is to New York City. You know, this is nearby. They go round and round and round and round. They do experiments and have names that very few of your friends can name what they're doing up there or what their names are, or how long they're going to be up there. And it's exciting that there's a space station. Are most people really tuned into it? I'm not sure they are. So, okay, so now we've gone back. For the first time, we've sent an American-made rocket. That's exciting. U.S. astronauts that don't have to bum a ride with the Russians. I guess that's exciting, too.
What about a reusable first stage that lands on a platform in the ocean? That's pretty
exciting.
Yeah,
that's the coolest thing of all, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
That's an amazing bit of engineering. Yeah. But, you know, Valerie, the real goal here, if you listen to Elon Musk, he wants to colonize Mars. And I know that
right. This
is an exciting topic we've discussed on this show. Bob generally is in the skeptical category on that one. But let's go to Valerie first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm skeptical in some sense. I hope it happens, and I'm cheering them on. And I think, you know, building these rockets and launching the astronauts from the U.S. is the next step forward. But there are so many engineering challenges that we have to overcome. And I've spoken about this in many different talks to the public. And it's just like, we have to think about, okay, Mars doesn't have the air or the water or the food or really anything that we need to survive. So we need to figure out a way to bring everything with us and survive in this place that really wasn't meant for human beings. So I'm not saying that we can't do it. I just think we shouldn't be so naive to think it's going to be as easy as it was to go to the moon in relative terms. Mm. You know, there's, once we go, there's no coming back for 3 years' time. So you really have to commit to going to Mars if you're going to go.
Bob.
Well, yes, this also has that on the one hand and on the other side aspect. You know, on one aspect of it is we sending humans to another planet. And there is only one planet we can do it. It's a default situation because the planets beyond Mars don't have a surface. You can't land on something without a surface.
Well, the moons do.
Pluto, which is not considered a planet anymore. So after the moon, when you're actually talking about a planet, nothing past Mars has a surface. It's all just gases, and then maybe it'll turn into slush.
Well, the moons
do,
though, Bob.
I'm sorry, say again?
The moons of those giant gas planets.
You and I are in agreement there. It would be nice to visit the moons of Jupiter. All of them are interesting. Io has volcanoes. Europa has water. And a very good possibility, I think, of life. And Ganymede's the largest satellite in the solar system. But unfortunately, they all orbit very close to Jupiter's lethal radiation zones. Mm. Jupiter's magnetosphere traps in radiation, and these moons have the same radiation on their surface as you'd get by standing in the core of a nuclear power plant. So that's not friendly either.
Yeah,
and long-winded way of saying Mars is the default. So it's the only planet that's not unbearably hot like Mercury and Venus, and it has a surface. But as Valerie pointed out, it's far less hospitable than the Antarctic, where people aren't exactly lining up to live. This is a place with essentially no air. The air is only 1% as thick as ours, and what there is just carbon dioxide. And so the radiation is high, and the conditions are very, very hostile to Earth. And I always worry about what will happen when the first human dies there. It's inevitable, but when it happens, will the public immediately lose their fantasies and their excitement about, yeah, let's keep sending people, let's colonize, let's put cities up? I think once the reality really hits home, it may lose some of its luster.
All right, Valerie, final word here, and then we'll take a break and then go to the phones.
Well, I just think we should go for it, because even if we don't ever make it to Mars, I think we're going to develop so much great technology, and if the United States even gives it a try, it'll be a great sense of pride for us. So I'm all for trying, but I'm pessimistically optimistic, I guess you could say, in whether or not we're actually going to succeed in this.
Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's Astronomy Today. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. A couple of emails and then phones. It's all on the way. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Ray Graff here, and the number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question about Astronomy Today. A couple of emails here, and then we'll hit the phones. This one is from our buddy John. And John writes, a few nights ago, I watched the International Space Station fly by for my first time. I was thrilled to see it. But what kind of magnification would I need to see any details of it? I have good binoculars, but that's it.
Well, binoculars are insufficient to see detail, but any small backyard telescope, believe it or not, will show the antennae and will show the basic structure. And there have been a number of great shots taken by amateurs using just backyard equipment.
Yeah, the tricky thing is telescopes weren't really designed to track objects that are moving that fast, so it'll definitely take some practice to line it up and be ready for the pass right in front of the telescope. You can't actually really follow it across the sky with much ease.
You know, it's so exciting to see, though. And anybody who has been in a dark sky and seen this thing come over, it's very bright. It's really cool.
Oh, it's so pretty.
Yeah, it is. This email came in from Benjamin in Rexford, and then we'll go to the phones. Benjamin says, I've heard on TV that some scientists dispute the existence of dark matter, claiming that it can be explained away by altering our understanding of how gravity works over large cosmic distances. Could you please clarify the current, most up-to-date understanding of dark matter and whether or not it exists? Valerie, you first.
Yeah, so there are some scientists that believe that dark matter isn't an actual thing, but rather it's mathematics that we haven't quite figured out yet. To my knowledge, I think most of the astronomers are on the dark matter bandwagon. They do think it exists, and we have a lot of observational evidence for it. But others are working on what they call modified Newtonian dynamics, which is basically all the equations from Newton and Einstein that describe gravity and ways to tweak them to explain how the stars orbit the galaxies and explain what we see without introducing this extra mysterious matter that we can't see with our telescopes. So I think most people are still believing that dark matter is actually there, but others are working on some alternate theories.
Bob, we have talked about this many times in past shows. Your take?
Well, you start out with what made us think that it exists. If you look at our cluster of galaxies, we live in a group of about 30 galaxies, three spirals, and the rest are very small, mostly irregular dwarf galaxies. And the way we're moving, each of our galaxies, such as the Andromeda Galaxy and the M33, we have such speed relative to each other that we should escape from the mutual gravitational grasp of the entire group of galaxies we're in. But we're not. We remain a cluster of galaxies. And so when we look in the rest of the universe, we see clusters of galaxies that are also have individual members moving so fast, this cluster ought not to exist. They should have all gone their separate ways. They're not. So there's something gravitationally gluing the individual members in place. And then it gets worse than that. In our own galaxy, which spins in a very strange way, the galaxy has a very even spin. We don't get slower and slower as you get farther and farther from the center. Instead, we spin as if we're a solid vinyl disc. And the only thing that can explain that is if here too, not just outside of galaxies and between galaxies, but within our galaxy, and we see this in other galaxies too, there is somewhere between 6 and 8 times more gravity that can be explained by all the stars, all the planets, all the nebulae, all the dust, any black holes here and there. There can't be too many black holes because we'd see their individual effects, but any black holes we can't detect. And because of this, that's what dark matter is. It's unexplained gravity. Let's be clear about it. It's unexplained gravity. Right. Gravity that's not associated with something that gives off light or reflects light. So we have to postulate that the universe is made up of stuff that has either mass or has the ability to produce a gravitational effect, but without reflecting or giving off light. So this idea is maybe these are tiny new subatomic particles we never knew about. Maybe there's a whole different type of existence in the tiny realm of the submicroscopic that we didn't suspect, although it could also be baseball-sized, countless baseball-sized size things that are that have enough mass to supply the gravity.
Right.
In any case, that's what the issue is. Gravity without a seeming a source of it.
Right.
And as Valerie pointed out, the only getting away from that is that theory of MUND, M-O-N-D, first hypothesized in Israel, the idea being that, well, if gravity itself falls off in a different way than we thought, as you get farther and farther away from the source, instead of it falling off inversely with the square of distance the way gravity has always worked, we thought, what if at very low levels gravity behaves differently? And if that's the case, then we don't need dark matter.
Okay.
Then that alone can explain almost everything we see.
All right, now we have to get to the phones, but quickly, Occam's razor, we talk about it. What is more likely, that we don't understand gravity fully, or there's that six times the amount of mass out there that we can't see? Which is more likely?
They're very beautifully put, Ray. That you've really phrased the question beautifully. I can't answer that. Valerie?
I can't answer it either. I mean, they weigh the same in both hands. Both are either extremely simple or extremely complicated, and I can't wait to figure out what the answer really is.
All right, well, let's hit the phones then. 800-348-2551 is our number. Betsy in Schenectady. Betsy, you're on.
Hi, Valerie. Folks, so that this weekend there's a kids' arts festival where you get to explore the night sky with Dr. Val. And I was just hoping she would just talk a little bit about Star Wheels.
Star Wheels? What's that?
Yeah. So this weekend, you can tune in online to the Digital Kids Arts Fest, and we have an activity where the kids will have pieces of paper where they cut them out, and they make a little pocket for a wheel of constellations, and you turn the wheel, and it allows you to see what constellations are in the sky at whatever time at night you want to go outside. And it's a wonderful tool. I'm sure Bob has many of these types of tools that let you see what's in the sky at any time of year. And it's a great way to start to find constellations and figure out what's visible.
All right, Betsy, your signal's pretty bad on the phone, but I thank you for bringing that up. And when is this next one, Val?
So the event is this weekend online. Kids Arts Fest in Schenectady. People can find it there.
Oh, very exciting. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here at Bob Berman. It's astronomy today. And now we go to, hello, Joan in Schenectady.
Hello, and greetings to all y'all.
Hi.
Hi. First, just a quick response to people being excited about a moon launch.
Yeah.
I love it that we're thinking about sending Artemis, the sister project for Apollo, up to the moon. I truly will celebrate the launch and the landing just like I did back in the 60s.
Yeah.
That's great.
I'm happy for us. I'm paying attention to sunrise and sunset times, and over the last 2 years, I noticed that where we are, the average is about, 12 hours and 15 or 20 minutes of sunlight, daytime hours. Is there a part of the globe that makes up for that extra few minutes?
Yes, absolutely. If I should reply first to this.
Sure.
Yes, where we live at this time of year when we have maximum sunshine, we have about 15 hours of daylight, and then the remaining of the 24 hours, we're talking about 9 hours of non-direct sunlight. And it's exactly made up symmetrically. In the southern hemisphere, they have precisely the reverse. However, we did have a bias towards sunshine. Only on the equator is there exactly 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night throughout the year. It never changes, not in June, not in December, not any time at all. But there is a bias because our atmosphere bends the sun's image upward so that we have an extra several minutes of sunlight every single day that we would not have if we were the moon or any other body that didn't have an atmosphere. So because of that, if you add up the number of minutes and hours of sunlight during the year and the number of nighttime hours, there are more hours of sun than a 50-50 balance would suggest. We get about an extra week and a half of sun beyond that 50-50 balance because the sun's image is bent up. And that's why the days and nights are not equal on the equinox. You know, if you look in your local paper, you'll see that it's not, they don't match. We have more sunshine than night.
Okay. Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Joan. We appreciate the call. Bob Berman is here. Valerie Rapson is here. The number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. And Magenta in Stone Ridge, you're on.
Hi, how's everybody?
Good. How are you?
I'm a huge fan of this program, a huge fan of astronomy and space exploration. But I have an increasingly fundamental question. If we were to take all those brilliant people who can send things to Pluto, turn on a dime, send the signals back, photographs, all the unbelievable things that the minds in NASA and related areas can do, what would happen if we took those people, or even some of them, and implored them to address the problems that we have on this planet? For instance, the electricity grid, maybe developing fusion, climate change systems, so that we're in such an incredibly primitive state on so many levels in terms of technology on this planet and with such dire results. It seems ridiculous, the unbelievable things that can be done by these people, and that these minds and careers are not being directed to what it is we have here. What, we want to go to Mars so that we can plunder and mess up another planet?
Yeah. Well, that's one way to bring down an astronomy show, Magenta, but I think you make a point.
I will say, too, that, you know, a lot of the effort that's put into these spacecraft and things, it does trickle back down. I mean, the fact that we have developed satellites that help turn back towards the Earth and provide us with great weather predictions and photography of our planet. So some of what the astronomers do actually does focus back on the Earth. So it's not all a loss to focus beyond our planet as well.
And I think you make a point, Valerie. A lot of the research that goes into, let's say, the moon, the original moon landing, I mean, there is spillover in technology throughout society, right?
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's why we have satellite TV and internet access and cameras inside of our cell phones. I mean, a lot of that really...
Yeah, but how about fundamental things like food systems, water, hygiene, health, things like this that you better believe they also have expertise in?
You make a great point.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Yeah, I think it's just, you know, interest that people have, and hopefully we will be able to fix some of those things. Because I agree, as Bob said earlier, there's no other planet for us to go to that's going to substitute for Earth.
So you make a point.
We got to focus on this one, too.
Well, Magenta, that was a very well-stated point, and we appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551, Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and our own Bob Berman and Tom in Gardner. Tom.
Hello, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to applaud the last caller.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need to fix things here. Okay. Anyway, this is about dark matter and gravity. I heard Bob express what dark matter is very clearly to me, that dark matter was what we use to explain the behavior of gravity that we don't expect. I believe that's what I heard. My hypothesis, or the way I look at it, my lens, is that gravity itself is merely what we use to explain the behavior of matter. Now, you were talking about galactic motion, both intergalactic and intragalactic. And so there seemed to be this connection between the galaxies. Well, what about quantum entanglement? I see them as connected. And my hypothesis, I'll just put it out there,
sure,
and I'm going to hang up,
okay,
is that everything that we see that we call matter is just one aspect of a crystal, one side of a crystal, one aspect of reality. And what really is going on is there's something that we're all a part of and we're all embedded in. And there's no empty space where there's absolutely nothing. The galaxies are connected. The photons are all connected. And I'm going to hang up and you can have your laugh.
No, it's not a laugh, man. Okay. We call this a lava lamp moment. And Bob and I have talked about this many times.
The caller is quite right. And, you know, when you're talking about, well, what, you know, what are we really talking about? What's there? You know, Ray and Valerie, that that's pretty open-ended. We could say that in the emptiness of space, we found that there is incredible energy that called the vacuum energy that fills space. That's more powerful than any other energy than we could conceive of. So what's that all about? We know that consciousness, we've known this for a century now, influences the way physical matter behaves, and that things that are observed one way actually change how they are, as, for example, whether they are particles or waves relative to if they're observed a different way. So what is consciousness? Is consciousness synonymous with the universe? Is this another name? Is mind and the universe one? So all I'm saying is that we go on and on with the caller's ideas. Why limit ourselves essentially to mass and gravity? However, the original caller was asking about dark matter. And if we care about what this phenomenon of dark matter is, there we must confine ourselves to the effect of gravity, because that's what is tied in with dark matter. And gravity, in turn, is a function of mass. The more mass, it's exactly proportional to mass. So our bodies, baryonic matter, atoms, depending upon how many protons they have, essentially, is the mass. And the warpage of space-time, as what Einstein told us, is proportional to the amount of mass. So here we see gravity's effects in the universe, but without any visible mass, without any light, without any reflections, without anything being given off. So this is the mystery that we're trying to figure out with dark matter. And it's sort of separate from all these other things that can kind of can spill over into philosophy.
Valerie.
No, I think Bob is 100% right, and it's just going to take more time and more studying to figure out exactly what this dark matter is. And one of the things astronomers have been trying to do is determine on what scale it actually acts. I mean, we know it seems to be directly related to matter, as we've said, but does it act within the solar system? Does it act within the galaxy? Does it act in between the galaxies? And we've seen that it acts mostly on a larger scale. And that just makes it that much more challenging to really study and understand.
Let's take a quick break here. Bob Berman is on the show. Valerie Rapson is on the show. It's Astronomy. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. We'll be back. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Ray Graff here. Number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here, and Bob Berman is here. A couple of quick emails, and then back to the phones. This one is from Kay, and the subject heading is Mars/human biology. Kay writes, I feel as if I'm missing something about the allure of colonizing Mars. What exactly is the attraction? Also, it seems as if people like Elon Musk are not considering the basics of human biology. Does he not realize that we are dependent on millions of microorganisms that live in our bodies, the human microbiota? What happens to these creatures that we depend upon in the presumably artificial sterile environment like the one we have to live on in Mars? Not to mention the potential psychological effects that might result from leaving planet Earth. And that's from Kay.
Right. That's exactly what we are trying to figure out with a lot of current studies. NASA is doing simulated missions to Mars where they're, you know, putting people in small spaces for 500 days and saying, okay, let's pretend you're on Mars. How are you affected both biologically and mentally? Can we, you know, simulate as much as possible? Obviously, we can't simulate lower gravity and things like that on planet Earth, but we can do a lot of these tests to see what type of effects might happen on Mars, and the caller is exactly right. Like, we don't know what's going to happen to the human body, and we're trying to figure out as much as possible before we get there, but it's still a big mystery. We really don't know what's going to happen.
Yes, and beyond what Valerie just said, there's something else, and that is there's a vibe to Earth. I know I live near Woodstock, so that's why I talk like that.
Right.
But there is so many things that comes along with living on Earth that we theoretically can't sense. Like we humans can't sense our magnetic field, for example. But there's so much that goes along with being Earthlings. It's in our, not just in our blood and in our lymph and in our nervous systems, but it's also, it goes deeper than that. There's a familiarity that when we go to Mars, it's not going to be there. It's not just not feeling a morning breeze or hearing the chirping of birds at dawn or the things that we might very quickly start aching for and missing terribly. And the effects of that psychologically on us and to our very nervous systems could be catastrophic. It could be deadly. So beyond the science that Valerie was talking about, beyond the radiation, the enhanced radiation, and beyond the perils of being in a place where you can't breathe the air, are the horrible loneliness of being utterly outside of our home, that's within our bodies and is part of us, and nobody knows what that's going to be like. And yet, at the other hand, you know, we're humans. We like to explore. From the time we were kids, and we rode our bicycle in the neighborhood, and then maybe as we got older, we backpacked through Europe or traveled the world. So it's in our nature to want to explore. And Mars is the only planet that we could step foot on safely. So of course we're going to wind up doing it, but who knows what the effects are.
Right. I know doctors are super concerned about that moment when the astronauts are halfway in between, because they're halfway to Mars, but they're halfway away from Earth, and then the question becomes, who do you belong to, right? And how do you handle that mentally of are you now a Martian? Do you belong to Earth still? You left? There's all sorts of things that we don't know how human beings are going to be able to handle.
All right. This email came in from Drew. And Drew writes, isn't it true that gravity can't really be explained? You said unexplainable gravity, but we still haven't really understood the idea of why gravity is a force. We know what it does, but we don't know what makes it do what it does. And that's from Drew.
That's quite right. There's four fundamental forces. We understand two of them, the strong and the weak force that only acts within atoms. Electromagnetism is another force, and its consequences give us familiar things that we see around us, light, magnetism, our fans blowing, our air conditioning. But then there is gravity. Einstein said, well, gravity is merely a bending of space, that anything that weighs anything warps the space around it, and as you pass through it, you've got to act and orbit or be influenced by this warped space. But just because he put it that way doesn't mean that we really understand it. Of those four forces, gravity is the only one that doesn't fit in with the others. We found a way to even combine them and show that in the extreme conditions of the early universe, soon after the Big Bang, yes, electromagnetism could have been combined with a weak force inside of atoms. So we have an electroweak theory that shows how there could have been a oneness between those other forces, but not gravity. Gravity has so far refused to fit in with the others. So whoever is now saying that it's a mystery, yes, it's a mystery.
Doesn't that make you, as a scientist, Valerie, a little, I don't know, concerned that you can't figure out this basic force?
I mean, I think it makes it more exciting. You know, there's constantly things that we don't understand that we're striving to understand. And every time we add a little bit more of an answer to the question, 15 more questions pop up. And I think that's one of the allures of science, is that there's always more to understand. You think you've got it, and then you realize there's a million more questions.
All right. Last...
That's brilliant, Valerie. What you just said is so right. The questions, in a real sense, are more fun than the answers.
All right, so yeah. Last email and then back to the phones. The number is 800-348-2551. Stephen Kingston writes, two questions. One, how often does the ISS get hit by debris from all the old satellites?
Well, almost never.
I hope not.
That's why we call it space, because there's a lot of room up there in between things. And fortunately, the collisions between previous satellites or bits of them, which is what's really creating the problem, because pieces go into other pieces and create more debris. But there has not been enough, and that's a good thing, too, because a collision in space, if something is going in the opposite direction as you, it's going to be hitting you at something like 18,000 miles an hour. So even the smallest debris can do grievous damage.
All right, but Valerie, last night, SpaceX, they sent up 60 more Starlinks. I think there are 500 maybe now out of many more to come. At some point, will we need a traffic cop up there?
Well, that's something we're definitely talking about, because there really isn't a single governing body that controls where everything goes and what gets put up there. We're definitely monitoring the orbital heights of all of these satellites, and there are restrictions around putting other satellites in the orbit of the ISS, because if it does break or become uncontrollable, we don't want it to crash into the space station. So we're extra careful about that. But yeah, that's something they're seriously thinking about, is when you have, 12,000 Starlink satellites, ultimately, it's going to get a lot more crowded, and there's a lot higher of a potential for things to collide and damage to occur.
All right.
And beyond the damage, why should this even be allowed? Because this is visual. All of us look up. Mm-hmm. The sky is half of our visual field. The ground is one half. The sky is the other. What if somebody said that they're going to change clouds forever, do some sort of scientifically or technologically required thing so that we all have cell phones? Oh, but what it's going to do is make clouds square from now on.
Oh.
Or take away their visual appearance so that we'll never be able to see clouds the same way again. Wouldn't we all say, hey, wait a second, that's part of nature. You can't do that without us all talking about it and voting about it. So the Starlink and the other companies that are going to do it are creating a situation where we will have more artificial satellites than there will be stars in the night sky.
Mm.
And who said that that's okay?
Okay, well, we'll pick this up on the next program. We have a lot of people who have been waiting, and Steve had another part of his question about terraforming using nuclear weapons. We'll pick that up on another show as well. Let's hit the phones, because Greg in Albany has been waiting a very long time. Greg, you're on.
Hi, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Love the show.
You bet.
My question is really about the moon and the light we see from the moon. So I'm sorry it's not a gravity question.
That's okay.
But real quickly, my observations are just my own. When I was young, I used to be able to see the new moon, and a few days after the new moon, you get like kind of the thumbnail effect, and then you can see the shadow side of the moon. And the shadow side of the moon is a result of Earth reflecting the sun's light to the shadow side of the moon and then back to our eyes, so we can see that. And I'm assuming you can see that more then, because the sliver of moon that's lit by the sun is minor, so you can still see the rest of the circle. Now, I've noticed that when I was young, you could only see it during the new moon, like a few days after the new moon, and then it would kind of disappear because the moon's growing and then your optics kind of lose the shadow side. However, in my novice observations, it seems as though I can see the shadow side later in the moon cycle, 3 and 4 days and 5 days. So that would suggest to me there's more reflective light coming off the Earth, thus lighting the shadow side of the moon lighter than it did in previous years. Is that possible?
Can I take this
more
one?
More clouds?
Go for
sure.
It.
Yeah. So what we've got with the moon and the Earth is a reciprocity of phases, which means that anytime you look at the moon and it's a very thin crescent, if you were on the moon at that time, Earth is almost a full Earth. Earth is a very gibbous, fat Earth. When the moon looks half to us, that is first quarter or last quarter, we look half to it. So the phases are exactly reciprocal. So because of that, your correct observation that whenever we see a new moon, actually a few days after the new moon, when it's a thin crescent, that's just when there's a very fat, almost full Earth in the lunar sky giving its maximum light. Now, you're right. The more clouds we have on that part of Earth at that moment, the brighter the Earth is going to appear, and the brighter this Earth shine, because that's the name given to this effect, the brighter the Earth shine is. But by and large, the difference is not enough
for people to notice. Generally, anytime, okay. You'll see this later this month, for example, that you can see a thin crescent moon, you'll see the dark side, the unsunlit side, glowing with the light of Earthshine hitting it for the reasons I just outlined. And yes, theoretically, right. If it's a very cloudy hemisphere or an unusually cloudy time, or clouds have a higher albedo, a higher reflectivity than the rest of the planet, Earth will be brighter and the Earthshine will be a little brighter.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for validating my observations. And it makes a lot of sense. So thanks for the answer. I appreciate you guys very much.
Pleasure.
Greg,
pleasure.
Thanks a lot for the call. Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman is here. It's Astronomy here in the waning moments. 800-348-2551. Howie in Syracuse. Howie, how are you doing?
Good. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
I just got a simple question. Isn't it possible that gravity is caused purely by the motion of an orb flying through space combined with the motion of our solar system flying through space at a high rate of speed combined with the force of the motion of our galaxy flying through like a multiverse? So if you combine all these different motions, all these different motions of these different entities flying through space at high rates of speed and spinning, it creates all this creates all this gravity on all the points of the Earth, simply from the motion and spinning of all these different entities.
Valerie,
isn't
what do you think?
Is that a possible theory?
Well, we've seen so far, based on what we understand about gravity, is it's truly the mass that causes the gravity. So it matters how big you are, how much material is there. The motion doesn't necessarily govern how strong you're going to feel that gravitational force. But objects, moving through space, they do generate gravitational waves or ripples through space-time. So there is a slight effect there, but not in the sense that you are thinking where, things are held together by gravity because they're moving. It's really the mass that seems to be holding them together.
All right, Howie, thank you very much. And over to Eli.
Although, Ray, as you know, Roberto Duran disagreed.
No mas. Right. I remember that fight very well. Sugar Ray Leonard. Eli in Woodstock, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. In the fall of 1964, I was at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and it was early in the morning. They got us up early, and we were outside, and there was a delay in us doing stuff. So I was just laying there on the ground looking up, and to my astonishment, I saw a satellite go over, and it was absolutely crystal clear. It was no question about this satellite. Was I looking at Sputnik?
Well, there are thousands. There, even back then, there were hundreds of satellites. So I don't know which one you were seeing.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Ever since October 4th, 1957, there have been at least one satellite, and now there are thousands. So,
but there couldn't have been hundreds
time,
in 1964, right?
At that time, by the way, there were still some very bright ones. Remember, you'll remember there was Echo and Telstar and some that at one time used only their size and reflectivity to let radio waves passively bounce off of. And these look quite bright.
Hmm. Oh, this was really – it was like a tiny, tiny moon.
Oh. Well, I mean, maybe it was an SR-71 if it was 1964.
Well, now you're saying that if it had size, it was not a point, like it wasn't a point.
No, you could actually see that it had, it was a circle, yes. It was not a point of light, definitely.
Okay, well, then now we're not talking about satellites because satellites don't have, to the naked eye, they don't have a size to them. Now we're probably talking about a military aircraft or perhaps an actual balloon that somebody was flying or something or other, but not a satellite.
Ah.
Really?
There you go.
Yeah, really.
Huh. Well, there you go, man. Well, that's great.
No, it's only been 60 years almost.
Well, thanks, okay. Eli. We appreciate the call. Let's go to Clark in Voorheesville. Clark, you're on.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call.
You bet.
Question about what does it mean when we refer to
a what?
There.
We lost you there for a minute, Clark.
Substance?
Start again.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Is there substance to a gas planet?
Is there substance?
In other words, if I mean, could you stand on a gas planet? Can you land on a gas planet?
No, you can't stand on it, but of course there's substance, because gas is just one of the phases of matter. And, for example, Jupiter has the same mass as 318 Earths. That's an awful lot of mass, a lot of matter, a lot of stuff, and yet it's essentially all gas, almost all gas, but you still couldn't stand on it.
Well, no, wait, you said almost. That means there's something other than gas.
Because when you get to the core, the gas gets so compressed. Valerie was talking about this last time, actually. As you get more and more compressed, it's mostly hydrogen composition starts acting like a metal and can conduct electricity. And so if you somehow could get yourself to the core, and you could stand there, but boy, you sure wouldn't want to.
Yeah, I think you wouldn't survive that one.
No, you would not survive. A lot of atmospheric pressure at that point, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Clark, thanks a lot. Uh-oh. Let's go to Luke in Western Massachusetts. Luke, you only have about 30 seconds here.
All right. Well, I just wanted to express my disappointment about the panel's reluctance about the Starlink system. You know, our society paid for last-mile internet 20 years ago, and we've been robbed blind by, you know, corporations that run it. Internet is almost a human right at this point, and there are millions of kids that don't have it, and they can't do their schoolwork without it.
You know what, Luke? You make a great point. Now, we're about out of time, but there is that side of this, that this will bring internet to a lot of people who couldn't have it, and given the lockdown of the pandemic, it's very important. So I think, Luke, you make a valid point, and we'll bring that up on the next time that we have these two on the program. But there is a flip side to Starlink, and I talk about this with my brother, who is a proponent of this. Anyway, Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, thank you both for being here. Appreciate it very much. We'll see you next time.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Support comes from Sinopoly Insurance Agency in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, assisting farmers with equine, livestock, and farm insurance. Information available at 413-528-1710. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. Well, once again, thanks to Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for listening. The astronomy shows always bring forth great questions, and today was no exception. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered by Charlene Knight. Our producer is Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, it's Food Friday with New World Bistro's chef Rick Orlando. Stand by for the Capital Connection.